So for Froome to have competitors, which drives up the interest in the race, and it drives up his salaries and TV and then sponsors, and it gives rise to selling more bikes and jerseys, he, Froome, actually needs BMC to be in the game, and he needs Cannondale Drapac, he needs AG2R, he needs all the other forms of teams, and they need to be a success at keeping the teams. I don't know if they need to be successful racing teams, but they need to be a success at having a team. So if they go away and Sky is all that's left that is, then it's not a league anymore. It's not even a sport. It's just one team. I don't even know what that is. Hello and welcome back to the Between Two Wheels podcast. This is your host, Tyler Yonke, and thank you for joining us for episode 11. Today we're going to do a little Vuelta rest day. I hope maybe you need a rest day after the weekend and all the races that went on. But anyway, we're going to talk about some local racing. We're going to go over the news and notes of the day in the world of cycling. We'll do a little recap of the weekend's Vuelta stages and then maybe look ahead to see what's coming up. Just wanted to start out real quick with some local Northern California racing that went on. We had the Henleyville Road Race. Sadly for some of the participants here, this doesn't always get a lot of field participation, so we'll just go over some of the results here. In the P1-2 race, you had about 22 starters, it looks like, and about 19 finishers. Problem you have with this race and with not getting enough participants, when I've done it in the past, is you get one or two guys starting to break away up the road, and then you get a few chasers, and before you know it, there's not a peloton anymore. That's the peloton is up the road. So you always got to be on your toes for this. This race itself isn't very hilly. It does have a kick finish. Too bad it's not getting enough participation. And once again, I'm saying this as someone who did not go out there myself. It was a little warm this weekend. It was busy. You got family stuff going on. End of the year. It happens. All right, so first place in the P1-2, you had Zach Morvant from Dolce Vita Freewheel. Second place, Jeff Bouchak of the Davis Bike Club. Third place was Adam Naguib of the TMB Development, PB Equator. That's Teams Mike's Bikes. Robert Lander of MAN Cycling in fourth. Michael Claudio of Thirsty Bear in fifth. Corey Duran of AMAIN in sixth. Jason Grafath of Thirsty Bear in seventh. And then our guy in the news last week, Cole Davis of the Team Specialized Juniors, who, as we mentioned, is signing on with Action Berman. So good to see him out there finishing off his season. And the Masters race, the 1-2-3, we had two riders entered and one finished. So we're not even going to go down that route. The Masters, the 45, they had about the same. Well, they did 22 starters, 19 finishers. We'll just go over the top real quick. Phil Tercera of Cortex, Phil Malaspina of Cortex, Sean Smith of CA Technologies, Andrew Edelman of Cortex, and Greg Chapla of Davis Bike Club. So Cortex taking the reins there in the 45, 1-2-3. In the women's, you only had seven entries. Christina Bonington of JL Velo won. Her teammates were second and third, Emily Mather and Ali Balela. I hope I didn't slaughter any of those names, but congrats to everyone there. The next day we had the Esparto TT. So it's blistering hot here in Northern California, 106, 107. I don't know why these guys decided to put on a non-breathing aero helmet and go out there and pound the pavement on the time trial, but nevertheless they did. And the P1-2 field, Kevin Metcalf won. He's definitely a Masters rider. He's world level. I think he tried the hour record this year. I'm not sure of his age, but he's close to 50 and he goes really fast. So seeing him win the P1-2 field was not a surprise at all. The Masters 35, we had Michael Claudio, who had got fifth the day before in Henleyville, so he's riding nice and high. Of Thirsty Bear, he got first. Rob Herrick of Revs got second, and just over 5 seconds ahead of him. Rob Herrick just beat my teammate Christopher Flower of DDA Racing by 5 seconds. So Chris Flower rounded out the top three podium. The Masters 45, they had the bigger field at only 11 entrants. And Chris Phipps won that perennial national time trial champion in his Masters division and also a road race champion. So in the women's, Marissa Axel of JL Velo won her race. So congrats to everyone there in the Esparto time trial. Next we have coming up next week is Red Kite Championships, I believe, on Saturday. Then you have the Masters Championships, Crit Championships on Sunday. And then Monday, the holiday, we have the Giro de San Francisco, which is a great race downtown San Francisco. Check that out. Come join us. And, you know, good luck to everyone doing that. All right, so the news of the day, a lot of breaking news over World Cycling this weekend. And the biggest one, we'll just start out right with it, is the Cannondale Drapac. So there was news of them where they basically had a $7 million shortfall of a potential sponsor coming up for 2018. From what I heard, an interview with Jonathan Vaders, it wasn't one of their already newly announced sponsor, Oath, or their existing sponsor, Drapac. And I think it's been pretty well known that Cannondale is going to be coming out as a title sponsor. So they were looking to replace that. And the word was that they had someone, and then that company pulled out. You know, they had to go through the board. They'd had an initial, hey, we're definitely on here, but they had to have everyone sign off on it. And evidently you had one person on the board or two, I don't know what it was, but they decided that this was just not the kind of revenue, marketing scheme plan that they wanted for their company. So they backed out. Vaders didn't give any indication of who that was. And, you know, that's happens. That's part of that. It came down, I guess, on Friday, the 25th. And so Vaders let his team know, or the rider agents, and they wanted it to keep silent. And then it leaked out. So they ended up making a full press release on Saturday, the 26th. Quite a huge shock, actually, in the cycling world. A lot of talk about it, especially as the Vuelta is going on, and their own man, Michael Woods, is right in the mix. And Cannondale's, you know, had pretty strong second half of the year. They'd had a 2-year drought, it appears, there of not winning any World Tour races, and then suddenly, right around the time that the Tour of California came along, they started winning, and they've been kind of on a tear since then. It's been good to see. While it was somewhat of a shock in the cycling world that they were coming out, and that's simply because they had signed, you know, a 3-year deal to Rigoberto Urán for the next 3 years, so it appeared that they were pretty stable. There's not necessarily a shock when a sponsor pulls out. I mean, this is the way, you know, it's precarious dealings that you have with the sponsors and the way this whole thing is structured in cycling. So it's, well, teams always, you know, that's typically why you're seeing 2-year contracts everywhere. They don't want to extend them out. You don't have lifetime contracts because a team, you don't know how long they're going to be in it for. So there's always that problem. So while it was a shock in this instance, because it appeared everything had been set in place and they had been signing new people, when you look back at it as the overall thing in cycling, it's not necessarily a shock. It appears that Cannondale Drapac is going to try to do some crowdfunding. So while they have Drapac involved, they have other sponsors, they need another $7 million. So they also said, Vaders had indicated in an interview that he had someone step up, said, hey, we'll do it. I'll do $1 million personally. And so basically they need $6 million to sustain this, to at least have 17, 18 million, I think, for next year to run a team, which is interesting in comparison to the 30 million of Sky. So they're actually going to try maybe do some crowdfunding. So perhaps kind of like the Green Bay Packers, where you can own a part of the team, that might be a possibility as well. And that's maybe the way it's going to go here for cycling. You know, we can talk about the whole business model and the way it's structured. There's a new team, Aqua Blue, that's a continental team, and they are basically trying to do like a website hub where that is all the way that they sustain their team. And it's kind of like an Amazon idea for cycling. And evidently it's been working just fine, where they get their revenue, and that revenue from this website solely sustains the team. Well, I guess the team owner is pumping some in, but he doesn't want to go out for any other sponsors. And, you know, that seems like a good model for them specifically, but you can only do so much. And I don't know what else you'd end up doing to get this. So the model itself for cycling, to me, seems broken. Well, actually, it's perhaps not broken. It's just, it's never been implemented in a way that's workable all the way around. I mean, you think about other leagues and sports that have a thriving system. Me personally, you know, the NFL has taken up World Soccer, all these different ones that are able to have the ginormous business and, you know, fund everything. But the difference on a lot of those, and it's obvious, is these models have some big differences. One, they have a stadium. They have a place where they can charge fans tickets to come into an event, use that stadium for other things. I mean, this is not the case in cycling. So you don't have this concrete area that you are able to do to charge people to come see your product. You know, cycling's out on the road, so your issue there is really TV revenue. You also have teams located, like I said, in a specific region in that area, and then they also a lot of times get subsidized by local taxes or city, you know, state to keep them in place. Now, personally, I don't actually think this is a good thing for cycling. We've seen a lot of, you know, if you really look at the breakdown of the financials, it's a bad situation actually for taxpayers, and it's really good for sports fans of that area. So I'm not sure that this is necessary. So the infrastructure of these teams, however, that they have them in place, it does, though, keep a sense of security. I mean, it takes a lot to move a team like from Oakland to L.A., from L.A. back to Oakland, then Oakland to Las Vegas. Well, maybe that's not the greatest example. But for the most part, it is more difficult to move these teams around when you have this league. Cycling just can't keep up with that. And, you know, a team can just stop at any time. And they often do. We know that Cannondale is in this situation. We never know if there's another team right now going through this and just not making it public. All right. So if you don't have a way to create revenue by having a stadium and ticket sales, then how do we actually afford these teams? I mean, it seems like to me then that's what your problem is. It's corporate sponsorship is the main way. You have some of these teams, you have Lotto Jumbo, Lotto NL, where they are actually a state sponsored lotto that's, you know, helping the team along. You've had that with the Basque teams, Euskadi, Euskaltel, where I think they were state funded. But even that, you know, at some point your economy goes up. I mean, it's like anything else. I don't know that that's the way that you're going to maintain viability as well. So maybe revenue sharing, which we said though, there's not a real league. And so therefore there's no revenue to sharing. It even exists. I mean, getting into the World Tour team itself is based on either team points, which it's then either an issue of contention, and do the points go with the rider? Do they go with the team? When a team folds, then who gets the points? If the rider gets the points, does the team not start a rider who's going to be leaving them the next year? You know, we're going to talk a little bit about Warren Baguil. Maybe that's the issue there. We've had that several times. The team just basically, you know, there's been state, hey, I'm not getting to ride at all. Some riders, I'm trying to remember back several years, there was an issue with the Trek team with Johan Brunil, and they weren't pushing a rider, and he wasn't getting any time. He wasn't going to do any races, and basically because he hadn't signed the next year. And so it's not like a punishment, but then their idea is, well, you know, we need points, and we need points for someone else. And the more you get, you're going to take it elsewhere. So anyway, there's that whole problem that comes into it. So perhaps ultimately you just need a league, some way to guarantee the riders are going to be entered into the Tour de France. Because when you're getting sponsors, those sponsors want the Tour de France. I mean, that's what it is. And so if you're losing riders and you're not having the team get into the Tour, then the sponsors don't care about that anymore. So, you know, you need that. Maybe you need that, like I said, maybe you need that league to guarantee entry into the Tour. I mean, I guess the downside is not accounting for new teams to make a splash into the marketplace. So, you know, you're not having this kind of influx of something coming in. You're setting it to, you know, we have 20 teams and these are the ones we just have for ad infinitum, so forever. I don't know. But this also plays into comments Chris Froome made in an article published by Villeneuve just today, which is kind of making a splash across the internet because it's, you know, rest day at the Vuelta. Okay, so Villeneuve posts this up, and I'll just get to kind of the comment they made and then Froome's comments and kind of do a play off of that. So the article starts out with, this portion. The Vuelta a España leader said Monday he laments Cannondale-Drapac's looming sponsorship problems. But he said pushing innovation is part of the cycling game. And then there's quoting. Yes. Quote, yes and no. It is in some ways unfair to support the support we have in general at Team Sky compared to other teams, said Froome, who gestured quotation marks with his hands when he said unfair. If you take that away, what do teams have to strive for? What are you working harder? To win more races? To take that away? It's almost as if we are becoming communists. All right, so that was what he said. And now, for some reason, this comment about communists really seemed to spark a few journalists and put them all in a tizzy, which I saw on Twitter. And I think that's because Froome seemed to shock their sense of this crappy economic theory that's should have gone to the wayside. And I'm not making a joke about that. I mean, Shane Stokes of the Cycling Tips, he does fine cycling reporting, but he's really wacky when it comes to other things he pushes on Twitter, and almost disturbing in a sense to your mainstream person. And he just dismissed this altogether. And he said, it's almost like Froome is exaggerating to a ridiculous extent. But I don't know. But is he? I mean, the reality is actually somewhere in the middle as I see it. The problem with Froome is maybe he doesn't understand the need for both. This is going to maybe cause problems, but a socialist aspect and a capitalist aspect combining together to make the sport work. So I'm going to rephrase that. I'm going to say it one more time to make sure that I said it right. You need a little bit of a socialist aspect and a capitalist aspect of the sport. And you see those in the sports that actually are successful, and you need those in a combination to make it work. And so in Froome's mind, his team is a separate entity altogether. It's Sky. And they're competing in this world as a corporation itself with these other entities such as Trek, Movistar, you know, BMC. These are all companies like their sponsors, the teams that is, and they don't share their books. They don't share their costs. They don't share their incomes with one another. Why would they? I mean, Sky itself as the company, not the team, they don't help CNN. Trek doesn't care about Cannondale or BMC. I mean, in fact, as corporations, they do what they can to take each other's business. Cannondale, Trek, BMC as you know, competing businesses. I mean, that's capitalism, and that's cycling as competitors. But here's the rub on that. So for Froome to have competitors, which drives up the interest in the race, and it drives up his salaries and TV and then sponsors, and it gives rise to selling more bikes and jerseys, Froome actually needs BMC to be in the game, and he needs Cannondale Drapac, he needs AG2R, and he needs all the other forms of teams, and they need to be a success at keeping the teams. I don't know that they need to be successful racing teams, but they need to be a success at having a team. So if they go away and Sky is all that's left that is, then it's not a league anymore. It's not even a sport. It's just one team, and I don't even know what that is. Okay, so the example I'd like to come up with, and I actually tweeted this out to Vodder several years ago, which he retweeted it and said he loved it, but it's the McDonald's. So you've got Mickey D's is just one company competing for your business, and they're competing for, you know, against Carl's Jr., Burger King, In-N-Out, whatever other burger company that's similar out there. So, but there's a bunch of Mickey D's throughout the state and the country and even the world, right? So, but sometimes they get really close to each other. You know, you have a McDonald's on one corner, you have a McDonald's just down the street. Now, corporate McDonald's, they have a different goal than perhaps each of those McDonald's, however, right? I mean, the overall goal for the corporation is that all the franchises succeed and that they just all make a success for the corporation as a whole. So it is for cycling. And each team as a franchise is like a franchise within that sport. So these franchises, they need to share revenue in a sense and the financial assistance kind of as a socialistic, you know, share the wealth to have this overall capitalistic venture of the cycling as a sport, I mean, to survive. I mean, you see that with Major League Baseball, right? Major League Baseball competing against NFL, competing against soccer, competing against NBA. But as each individual team, they need to be competing against each other in that sport, but they need to be sharing so that sport as a whole can compete against the other sports. So that's why I say it's like a franchise. I mean, Chris is right. Sky doesn't need to be riding the same bike as BMC, which he had kind of alliterated to further on in the article. I mean, they can have their own version of their diarrhea burgers, you know, but someone needs to be able to change. And I'm only pointing out these as a few issues. And I honestly don't know what the solution is. It's probably TV revenue sharing of some sort. Maybe that's what the Hammer series is coming in there, but there's no security in the sport as riders. And you know, like Joe Dombrowski made a comment. He's like, look, when you lose at the late part of the year and you don't have a team now to sign for, and a rider like Joe Dombrowski should be signing with another team, but now you have a lack of teams out there. You know, no one's coming in to fill the void. So he may just be out without a contract. He may not be riding next year. How difficult is it? He says it's almost impossible once you lose that contract and you're not continuing riding to get one the next time. And that's true. So he could be out of a career at an age when he should not be. And that's too bad. So, all right. And you can read more about that article on velonews.com. Just go there. It's one of the top ones you have. All right, so another issue we had this week, Warren Barguil was sent home from the Vuelta. And according to the team, Barguil openly expressed that he didn't race to conform to the team's goal, which left Sunweb with no other option than to take this decision, which was to send him home. So evidently Wilco Kelderman, his teammate, who they're riding for GC, he punctured on stage 7, and then Barguil refused to wait for him and help him out. Kelderman actually just came through stage nine with a fourth place, you know, only 8 seconds off of Froome. So maybe the decision to send home Barguil was the right one. I'm sure this decision was made easier based on Barguil leaving Sunweb next year for Fortuneo team. I mean, that Continental team that he signed for. I mean, in fact, Barguil just didn't sign with a different team. He had, it's a little bit strange because he's had another year left on his contract. And the word is he came to them in June before the tour and said, you know, he wanted to get out of it. And they're like, they had to get permission. And then, so that's, he's a bought out. So he actually had 1 year left. The new team bought him out. He has a great Tour de France. And now he decides to come into the Vuelta, and he's not lighting it up. I mean, you don't really know he's there. And then he's not willing to help his team. So they send him home. It's probably the right idea. I mean, I doubt a team like Sunweb. See, this is where you get back into this, to the tour and the team and the points issue. You know, Sunweb wants notoriety. They want to have, you know, a win. They want something. And obviously Warren Barguil gives them that. So keeping him in the race should be a good thing for team presence. Now, if he's doing things to undermine the team, then, you know, that's the reason to send him home. Now, they send him home just kind of like a, you know, F off and, you know, you're signing with another team, or they send him home because he's actually doing detrimental stuff to the team's overall goals. I'm not sure. And, you know, chime in what your take is on that. Also, this last week we had the Tour de l'Avenir. It's kind of the, well, it is the U23 basic Tour de France. They'd had 9 stages this year. We have, you know, past winners, Greg LeMond in 82, Indurain in 86, Fignon in 88, Nairo Quintana in 2010, Esteban Chavez, Barguil, they both won it. Adrian Costa, the U.S., was in second last year, but he's taken a sabbatical from racing. So this year they started on the northwestern part of France and then ended up going through the central and over to the Alps. And, you know, saw Nilsson Palace was out there and he looked to be having a good time, slowly just moving up until they had stage 7 or 8, I believe, and he lost a ton of time. And you had this one guy, this Colombian, Barnell. He ended up winning 2 stages, both in the climbing. Pelas actually on the last day got second place, and so he ended up with a nice finish on the stage. But Bernal kind of cleaned up, winning 2 big stages in the Alps. And as a result of that, he ended up signing with Team Sky, along with U23 world champ, who also won a stage or two there, Christopher Halvorsen, and then the Baby Giro winner, Pavel Sivakov. So all 3 of those big potential talents have signed up with Team Sky for the next year. And Tour de l'Avenir, good race. And it would have been nice to see some of that on TV, especially with these young guys, but it didn't happen. Just a word of note, Nate Dunn, a data-driven athlete coach, is doing a live web show on Zwift with Zwift on Facebook Live, I believe, Wednesday at 6:22 a.m. So go to facebook.com/data-driven-athlete. Check out Nate's coaching info there with Zwift. Okay, upcoming you have Tour of Alberta. I looked at the start list there, and it appears it's very much like Utah, Colorado Classic. So you have Haluesco, as far as the teams go. Haluesco, Cannondale, Drapac, UHC, Rally, Jelly Belly, Silver Pro, Medallion Ender. I think that's a Colombian team. Elevate KHS, Garneau, Quebecor, H&R Block, Avelo, and Amora Navita. So we'll have a little bit about that. Usually a Tour of Alberta is a good one to watch. Well, a good one. I don't know. We'll see if they put that one on the Tour Tracker again this year. All right. Let's get to the Vuelta. We had a little bit of recap here. Stage 8 and Stage 9. I had previewed that, and both of them had those short, punchy finishing climbs. So we had Helen to Jorac de Cati, 200 kilometers, that nasty finish up the quick glass ascent, and then 3 kilometers back into town. I don't know if you're able to see it. That was a really good race to watch. The brakes stayed clear until the final climb, where they had a little battle between Rafał Majka and Julian Alaphilippe. However, these two kept playing around with each other, and then Jan Polans of UAE team kept kind of just dragging himself back up. And Majka, the point on that one, Majka needed to drop Alaphilippe before the top of the climb, because Alaphilippe has a kick to him and he can win a bunch sprint of a reduced group, anything like that, he's going to be just fine on. So you can see Majka keeps attacking him. Alaphilippe doesn't do much, but just hang on his wheel. He looked really good. But there are even times where they're so steep and these guys are playing cat and mouse that they're kind of almost doing track stands up the climb before Micah would attack again. And then Jan Polants would basically be able to claw his way back. So he went over the top and Micah just couldn't shake Alaphilippe. And these two were, you know, set up for the final climb finish down the descent. But right before the finish, Polants comes up. He caught him. He tries to go straight through him. But the duo ended up catching back up, and Alaphilippe just made easy work of him. And Polants actually got second and Micah third. My little take on that is Alaphilippe, I think he should, and I mentioned him earlier as maybe a guy, you know, stage five where they're going into Andorra of suffering on the climbs, thinking that maybe he didn't have his, coming. I don't know if he was here for GC or not, but I think he should focus on these one-day races, these stages, and just stages themselves, stage hunting, and then the shorter seven-day tours like Paris-Nice rather than, you know, the Grand Tour, GC. I mean, he's young. He has the same kind of punch as Valverde. He does well in these classic types. But not everyone is a three-week Grand Tour contender. TJ. Well, maybe TJ is now. Who knows? But the problem I think you see with some of these guys is they do well in a stage, or they have a little bit of, top 15. They're like, oh, well, what if I just get top, 12 next time, or top 10? You know, maybe they start at the 20s and they start working their way. And I don't know, maybe the pay out there, it would be good, interesting to talk to a rider agent, but maybe the pay is better for a top 15 GC Grand Tour rider than it is to a guy that wins, five, seven races a year, but never the overall. I don't know. Anyway, right behind these two guys, he had the GC battle. And once again, there was a throwdown on the steep climb with Froome. He was attacking near the top, and only Contador was able to follow it. I did see it was a fascinating picture of Froome dropping Contador, and then suddenly Contador appearing back on his wheel when it looked like this motorbike had paced him up. I would say this is your typical home court crap, I'm sure, but on a climb that was that steep, it probably didn't make a huge difference. I just saw a few commentators making kind of a bigger deal about it online on Twitter, showing the photo. And it's a little ridiculous to see a motorbike trying to pace a rider back up the climb just because he's from Spain. Froome and Contador, they end up staying clear of the others on the final descent, and they gained, 17 seconds over Nibali, Aroo, Zakarin, Chavez, and then another 28 over Adam Yates, Kelderman, Woods, Roach, De La Cruz, TJ, and Menchies. So the top five after stage eight is Froome, Chavez at 28 seconds, Roach at 41, TJ at 58 seconds. Some quick observations about that. I mean, Froome was ridiculous, and some of his form right now just is stellar. And you can see that from the steep stuff, which sometimes he's had a little bit more trouble with, but this year he looks phenomenal. Contador is obviously coming back from whatever stomach problems or things he had, but he just can't get any daylight on Froome. And in fact, he's still trying to keep on Froome's wheel rather than the other way around. So he's obviously seems to be somewhat the better of the rest at times, but he's not at all where Froome is. Chavez, he lost a bit more time, and so it'll be interesting to see how he fares after the rest day and these other longer types of climbs. And the same with Nibali and Aroo, who both are usually on the attacking type of rider, but we've only seen that Peacock of Messina try his attack into Andorra, and I don't know if I see him as he's really got to come on, and he can be a guy that slows down, starts out slow and then ramps his way up. I just haven't seen any aggression really out of him. Now, while Woods also lost a short amount of time, he had attacked midway up. And this is likely something he just did he had actually said he got the adrenaline worked up and then he attacked, and it was probably way too soon to do. So I think if he plays it a bit more sensible, he might be able to just pull off the ride of the year, or tie Iran for that prize, actually. TJ and Nicholas Roach, these two, especially Roach, I don't think they're suited at all for this steep stuff. And that the Vuelta is throwing that out them, up through the first nine stages. So with that said, though, the steep climbs of the Vuelta are curbed by these shorter distance of the climb, and in effect, giving both TJ and Roach a shot that they might not be able to handle with on the Angrillu on stage 20. So while these steep sections are tough, they're not, they're like 3-5 kilometers at the most, where the Angrillu is longer, and now you're going to be coming up with longer climbs itself. And you also factor in that TJ had that crash, only losing a handful of seconds to these other GC rivals. It's probably a good thing at this point. I mean, he stated, as I've stated actually before, that, he's got this TT in his back pocket that he could probably do. If you look at all those guys in the front, bar Froome, Contador maybe, TJ is one of the ones set up to do a nice TT. All right, so stage 9, Arjuela to Cumbres de Sel, 174 kilometers. We previewed that as well. I mean, so this took the riders back up the coast, up the Med, and this time the sea was on their right side instead of coming down when they had previously gone more south on there. Now, the final climb, I didn't get this when I looked at the initial, but they actually tackled it twice, right around 50 kilometers to go to the finish, and then they looped around and came back and did it a second time. The second time up, they would turn left at the last 1,000 kilometers, I'm sorry, last 1K, and around the 800-meter section was really brutal, just like the first kilometer, actually, of the climb was. Okay, so the brake stayed away on the climb the first time up, but it was caught before the Peloton hit the second time. Kendale, Drapac, and Sky, they'd been on the front for most of the day, keeping this brake in check. And it's funny, you have the biggest and the smallest, basically, World Tour budget teams combined just to get the same result. One has an uncertain future, one has a very secure future, but they're both out there battling. And Froome actually gave Cannondale some props, saying it was impressive to see them riding the way that they had. I was also curious to watch the final climb, as it was steep enough to cause any rider trouble, yet the fear was really the one final 1K. So everyone kind of waited. You know, they hit the bottom, there was a few tacks here and there. I say they all waited. Well, Romain Bardet didn't. He attacked. He actually tried twice. He tried twice to get away and then finally did manage to break free about 1K to go. But sadly, he was kind of busting out of the back of the pack rather than up the road. So he tried twice, didn't make it, ended up getting dropped. It was also interesting just to see, like I said, they were just kind of going at a steady pace. Mikael Neve of Sky was kind of holding that. TJ was seen drifting back, and then he would, as the field just kept diminishing, and then he would just seemingly easily surge right up the side and right up to the front. So he was always kind of keeping himself there, but nothing was, I think he was anticipating something, but nothing was really happening. While watching the stage, I didn't hear at all the announcers Keenan or Baden-Cook mention Chavez, and I was looking for him. I couldn't see him, but I had been looking for his white jersey that he had, the combined points jersey that he had been wearing for quite a few days. And then inside the final about 800 to 500 meters, Froome just attacks, and boom, there's Chavez right on his wheel. He broke after him, and in his normal jersey, I could see it this time, and he was followed by Woods. Those three then distanced the field, shattering it basically to pieces, and Chavez looked like he was going to be connecting to Froome's wheel and just carrying Woods up for a possible, like, unintentional setup lead out for him. But Froome kind of did a look back, then drilled it again, gave more daylight between he and Chavez, and then there was a daylight between Woods and Chavez, and so Froome ends up the winner, punching the sky. He gets his first actual race day win of the year, which is kind of interesting. He won the Tour, but he hasn't won a single race other than that. So the damage behind was minimal. To some, it was more than others, but it all happened in the last 500 meters. You had Froome winning, Chavez 4 seconds, Woods 5 seconds back, Kelderman at 8 seconds, Zakarin same time as Kelderman, Contador 12 seconds, De La Cruz, San Oman, all in 12 seconds. Then you had Nicholas Roach, who did a nice finish there. You could see him really suffering. He did not look smooth on his bike. 14 seconds along with Nibali. Aru at 17. Van Garderen at 19. Let's see. We're drifting all the way down. Adam Yates at 27 seconds. Kruijswijk at 29. So we got the top 10 into the rest day. Chris Froome, overall leader. He had Chavez at 36 seconds now. And Nicholas Roach at a minute 5. So last time, I think the top 5 were still all within a minute. Now you have only the top 2 and Nicholas Roach basically right at a minute 5 in third place. Nibali at 117. Van Garderen still 5th at 127. Then you have De La Cruz, Aru, Woods at 8th for a minute 52. Adam Yates at 155. Zakarin at 215, rounding out the top 10. Simon Yates lost a bunch of time, so not sure exactly what happened to him, but yeah. He pretty much sat up, it looks like, and his hopes for overall are gone now. All right, so what's to come? Well, first let me just talk about TJ. I think he's riding, and I'm a big fan of his. USA, I like the kid. I've been a big fan of his for quite some time, and so I always hope, I'm always pulling for the hometown here. He's riding great, and once again, I think I'm buying into this, his underlying stock, and maybe more. maybe not the stock, maybe I'm buying some options on him. But as I pointed out, he's got a TT, and I think if he recovers from his injuries, he could be tough to get rid of. In addition, you look at these upcoming climbs, and they're definitely can suit him better. Well, they typically should. I mean, we've seen where he's cracked in the second half of the tour, but I mean, if he's gonna crack, he's gonna crack anyway. So I don't think the longer climbs what's gonna make him crack is just gonna be whether TJ does. So if he's running his engine the way that we've seen him go in recent years, you know, these type of climbs should suit him and Froome actually better. I suspect someone like Roach will actually be down lower in the top 10 and TJ to climb somewhere around third. I think Chavez should be able to maintain right around where he's at. But it's definitely going to be an interesting change because you're seeing, instead of these punchy, short, steep climbs, you're going to start seeing some, we're going to show them in stage 10, actually, you know, two big cat ones where you're looking at the last, 40 kilometers or more, 50 kilometers of not stage 10, I think it's stage 11, about 50 kilometers worth of climb. So right near the end. So those are not your, you know, super steep ones. All right, so as I said, stage 10. You have one big Cat 1 climb at kilometer 125 to 143, and then a 20-kilometer finish. Okay, so this is right after the rest day. This is tomorrow. I actually see a breakaway staying clear. I mean, a few guys will probably be losing touch on that front group, you know, but not a dramatic day to the GC. I see TJ has had trouble coming out of rest days, and so you could see him or others like that suffering a bit, but I think this stage actually will help them in effect that it's a cat one, it's long, but it's the only one in the climb and in the day, and there's a long descent, so I don't think you're going to see a dramatic GC shakeup. So that could help them, you know, kind of get through that one, and then we'll see what the next day is. Well, it's stage 11, two big cat ones, like I stated earlier, in the last 50K, they're stacked up right against each other. You go up one, descend, boom, you hit the next one. And the day has a really short little climb, not just some pitching in the beginning of the stage, like around kilometer zero up to 20 or so, and then it drops down to sea level. So you're then finishing this climb at 2,120 meters. So you're showing, you know, from sea level way up in the elevation for the finishing day. So that will be decisive. And like I said, it's finishing, it's a summit finish, and it definitely will be damaging. Starting with stage 10, after the rest day, you're basically this map. If you look at Spain, it's getting all twisted around. It's not your typical just going around Spain in one direction or another, or like we do in France or the Giro. This map, actually, we've been going down the Med, down the coast, and now we kind of came inland, and then we went back up. Now we're going back down, and we're going to head south and west towards Granada. And at some point, we'll head over to the Pyrenees as well. All right, so if you have any comments, you want to make a rant on anything I've said here, please let me know at cycletyler@gmail.com. Give us a tweet at Twitter at tyonki. Find us online. Give us a comment and a like, perhaps, or a dislike. But any kind of comments on any of the subscription platforms. Hopefully, we will see you at one of the races and introduce ourselves, maybe interview you. You never know. You could be that next star. Talk to you later.